Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to another edition of Focus Asia Pacific from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. New Zealand's Council for International Development recently hosted a panel discussion exploring the right combination of aid and trade to lift people out of poverty in developing nations, with a focus on the Pacific. Economists, trade negotiators, and NGO leaders recognize the combination of challenges the region faces, including climate change, distance from markets, and small populations. Dominic Godfrey attended.
The United Nations Millennium Development Goal of halving the world's extreme poverty by 2015 was achieved 5 years early, but Oxfam New Zealand's head says beneficiaries are predominantly male. Rachel Le Mesurier says the UNDP's figures from 2014 show 70% of the 1.2 billion people who still live in extreme poverty are female, with a tenth of the world living on less than US$1.90 a day.
So one of the things in this panel is we begin to look about what can we do to try and get to that last 10 to 11%. Oxfam's position would be focus on women and girls.
Ms. Le Mesurier says the significant economic gains women have made in developed countries have been achieved by participation in the workforce, but this is not the case in developing nations. So, can trade and trade deals improve the economic outlook for the most marginalised? Oxfam's head says an even playing field is fundamental.
How much are we asking people to do the same thing when they have far less of an infrastructure to enable them to play the game in an equal way?
Her views are echoed by Fairtrade Australia and New Zealand CEO Molly Harris-Olson.
Free trade needs to be one where the debates are in the open and in a transparent way. We're coming up with the solutions, and that the impacts on the livelihoods of the most marginalised are the most priority.
Ms. Olson worked in the first Clinton administration's Sustainable Development Council and has experience with the North American Free Trade Agreement. She says if Mexico sustained the same level of growth it had prior to NAFTA, it would now be on a par with South Korea economically. However, New Zealand's Deputy Director of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Vinny Nagaraj, highlights a different perspective.
What we have seen is poverty has been reduced in a really, really dramatic way, alongside a really, really dramatic expansion in trade and in commerce.
But is commerce and trade the key to lifting the final 10% out of extreme poverty? Molly Harris-Olson again.
I think it's been key. Clearly, economic growth has been vital. But we look at extreme poverty, we nowadays have extreme inequality. So I'd say that there's a very complex underpinning to this.
Ms. Olson credits the UN's MDGs and Sustainable Development Goals with giving nations a blueprint for prosperity.
They can enable humanity through the 193 governments, all the industries that are going to be already aligning around them, and the communities that care about these issues, to all know where they're going, how to track it, how to measure it. And that, I think, is going to enable us to end poverty if we do it properly in our lifetime.
Economist and commentator Shamobile Yaqub says the reduction in global economic inequality over recent years has also seen an increase in in-country inequality. But he thinks this will change.
Globalization and increasing integration has been something that's been very common. But I think the future, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, is going to be a period where globalization is going to be less commonly accepted.
IMFAT's Vinny Nagaraj says in the Pacific context, PACER Plus has many components that are unlike traditional global trade agreements.
There's development assistance that is linked to it. There are labour mobility arrangements that are being discussed in support of utilising some of the benefits of the agreement. What does that mean? It means that we're actually trying to address some of the questions that have come up around the fact that context in the Pacific is different.
Mr. Nagaraj says PACER Plus is more than just easing the exchange of goods and services. But Oxfam's Rachel Le Mesurier says a more holistic approach is required.
It's not enough to have a focus on an economic lens. There has to be an environmental context, particularly looking at social, health, education, tax systems.
Consensus among the panel was that an ongoing combination of aid and trade is necessary to elevate the Pacific's most marginalised. But NGOs and trade delegates agreed innovation was key to remaining relevant. This is Dominic Godfrey.
The Pacific Islands Forum is still relevant, and Pacific countries want New Zealand and Australia to remain in it. That's according to a new study. Stephanie Lawson from Australia's Macquarie University has been researching the history of regionalism and the way the forum has evolved since it was formed in the 1970s. Professor Lawson told Jamie Tahanaha she began by looking at the role of Australia and New Zealand.
I was interested interested in looking at, to start with, the issue of whether Australia and New Zealand really can be treated as a single and separate entity within the forum from the Pacific Island states themselves. Because that's a distinction I think that people sometimes make. Sometimes I think it might be right to make that distinction, but other times it just doesn't work. I think the relationships between the islands, Australia and New Zealand, and among the islands themselves are more complicated than that.
And that's been raised by particularly Fiji in regards to the forum recently, hasn't it? The role of New Zealand and Australia.
Fiji, under Frank Bainimarama, has been particularly vocal, but that's not a view that's actually supported, as far as I can tell, by any of the other island countries at the moment.
What is the role?
Well, it goes back, in the research I've been doing, I go right back to 1788, when Arthur Phillip set up the first colony in Sydney, I mean, and then 50 years later, New Zealand became a colony. But in that time, there was a lot of activity going on in the Pacific with European powers coming to and fro. And Australia and New Zealand have been very active in the Pacific from that very, very early time onwards. And although there's sometimes a bit of rivalry to the relationship, or sometimes people see it that way, they've worked very closely together to establish a form of control over the Pacific Islands region for their own security purposes, of course. And this has gone on, so that has given them a particular kind of role that is different from the role of island nations. But it still doesn't mean that you can simply divide off Australia and New Zealand on the one hand and all the island nations on the other in the contemporary political scene.
So do they belong in the forum?
I think they do. And I think they do because most of the island nations want them there. That's the reason they still belong, when it comes right down to it. I've been around the Pacific this year interviewing political figures. They might criticise Australia and New Zealand from time to time, especially over climate change issues, but none of them want to see Australia and New Zealand out of the forum at all.
What about the organisation itself? How has it changed over time?
The Pacific Islands Forum, well, as you know, it was set up in 1971 and it was to provide a venue for political discussions for the independent island countries of the Pacific, along with Australia and New Zealand. But it was set up because island leaders and Australia and New Zealand as well were quite dissatisfied with the South Pacific Commission as it operated at that time, largely because of attitudes on the part of the French and to a lesser extent the United States, because of the resistance to decolonisation and the absolute refusal to discuss political issues. So that's why the forum was set up at that time. Now, it's interesting that most recently the French territories in the Pacific, or at least two of them, New Caledonia and French Polynesia, have actually now been admitted to the forum as full members. So it's kind of come full circle.
What does this development mean?
Well, it can be looked at from a number of perspectives. First, it's an indication that France is perhaps not considered as a colonial power in the same way as it used to be considered. France has shown itself to be a great deal more flexible over the last 20 years in its attitudes to its Pacific territories. It's devolved a lot of autonomy to French Polynesia and New Caledonia in particular. And the demand, there is still a demand for independence from some groups within those two countries, but France itself has changed. And it's New Caledonia and French Polynesia, not France, that's been admitted to the Pacific Islands Forum. Now, some people might say, well, they're not independent from France, so they'll always have to do what France tells them to do. But in my interviews recently in New Caledonia, the people in government there insisted that that was not the case and that they do have autonomy to act in regional affairs.
Has the nature of the organisation itself changed in these past few decades too?
Well, it's taken on more and more jobs for itself, if you like. It's not just a talking shop. It has a lot of programs. It coordinates other regional agencies. It's got quite a large bureaucracy, and there's always been a worry that it simply duplicates what the Pacific community already does. But they do work to try and eliminate duplication. Sometimes there's a bit of rivalry, but there's probably room for the two regional organisations. But to get back to your original question, the Pacific Islands Forum has simply grown considerably from its starting point, just as any of these regional organisations have grown. So there's plenty for the forum to do now and in the future, and it's probably played a positive role in many areas of development.
Is the organisation still relevant? Does it need to change or anything? What's your conclusion about it all?
I think it does have a lot of relevance. It is the premier forum for political leaders in the Pacific Islands to get together. They've got the South Pacific Commission, but it's a different kind of organisation altogether. It's not a political organisation. The forum is. There is also the Pacific Islands Development Forum that Frank Bainimarama has set up, and it is still operating. I don't think it can achieve all that much, although it's attempting to forge a path of its own. But the Pacific Islands Forum is the one organisation which does draw together all those Pacific Island leaders and brings in Australia and New Zealand. And as far as all my research has shown to date, most of the Pacific Islanders wanted to remain that way.
Increasingly, Pacific people in New Zealand are trying to negotiate issues like culture, identity, and poverty in their struggle with mental illness. Health services have been called on to adapt their practices to suit, while those in distress are looking to draw strength from their family heritage, but avoid cultural pitfalls that can ensure simultaneously. In this report from Koro Varata, some names have been changed to protect their identities.
One in five people in New Zealand are said to suffer from depression of some form. Agencies say with many in the Pacifica community dealing with poverty and trauma, depression could be even more prevalent among them. Some of Salote's earliest memories are full of sadness.
Sharing this really tiny flat with my family, we were all crunched up into this two-bedroom flat. There was about 12 of us, and I remember feeling sad and thinking, is this how my life is going to be? And I was just not happy at all. And I remember hoping that I would wake up and be somewhere else richer, because to me, being poor was not a nice thing.
Salote, born in New Zealand to Tongan and Samoan parents, also struggled to find an identity of her own in her early years, leading to depression and later suicidal thoughts.
When you're a half-caste, quarter-caste, whatever, it is hard when it comes to identity, because you have all these people trying to say to you, who are you? I remember growing up and having both families, one family going, you are not really a Samoan because you can't speak the language. You are not really Tongan because you can't speak the language. And it was hard enough to grow up in New Zealand as an islander anyway.
Fileti's mental distress began with the breakdown of his relationship with his father on the back of a tragic death in their lives. However, he found solace initially in a new relationship with his soon-to-be Samoan wife before being led to seek help with a university counsellor. He says he's seen a lot of the Pacifica community suffering.
It's kind of in some ways like a virus. It doesn't discriminate and it's wide-ranging and it's pervasive and soul-destroying. It doesn't matter if you live in Remuera or in Flaxmere. We're susceptible as human beings to some form of depression or feeling down or not being able to cope.
Anita is a Samoan woman brought up in Hawke's Bay, where a traumatic experience during her school years triggered what she later learnt was clinical depression. She didn't feel she could share what she was going through with her family at the time.
It's a big burden for a teenage 12-year-old to think you don't want to sadden your parents, you've got to pretend that everything's okay. Being the eldest, I also had to look out for my sisters.
However, she says the cultural concept of tamato helped her.
The idea that we're all warriors and that we're all fighters, that was very important because my parents certainly were survivors and they were fighters. That's the thing that they taught, you know, that you've got to fight for what you want. We are warriors, you know, descendants of warriors. The only thing that kept me going when I have fallen into a terrible state of depression is that, yeah, I'm not going to let this beat me.
The impact of culture on mental health is no surprise to Monique Faliafa, the CEO of Leva, an NGO specialising in Pacifica health issues.
What we've got really strong evidence for now for young Pacific people is the stronger their cultural identity, the stronger their mental well-being. I get people asking, well, is it culture or is it mental illness or wellness? And for me, they're inseparable. They're both intertwined. The stronger the culture, the stronger the well-being.
Mary Maringikura Campbell, part of Wellington's Public Mental Health Services, agrees that it's important to know your family history so you have something to connect with. Ms. Maringikura Campbell also says young people need to be equipped with coping mechanisms to deal with bad times.
If we bring up our children, for example, to think that life is going to be great, we don't bring up our children to actually say, life is going to be great, but there's going to be some really hard times where, you know, life's shit, you know, and it's learning about coping with, you know, all the bumps on the road.
Ms. Maringi Kura-Campbell says Pacifica are some of the most stigmatised patient groups in New Zealand.
We don't have the same stigma when someone gets cancer, they get a lot of support, people feel very sad for them, but there's still this sort of feeling that people with mental illness have done something to deserve it, have done something wrong, maybe they've breached a tapu or whatever it is, it's their fault.
Ms. Maringi Kura-Campbell says if people were looked at holistically as emotional and spiritual rather than just a physical body, there may be a reduction of stigma. In the meantime, she says the sector should customise its approach to Pacifica, as psychiatric care is based on a Western model which doesn't always meld well with them. Auckland has a dedicated Pacific team, but Ms. Maringi Kura-Campbell says the rest of the country has a shortage of Pacifica nurses, doctors and psychologists.
Slowly we're getting more and more Pacific psychiatric nurses coming through, but you have to also understand that forensic and psychiatric nursing is not a very attractive pathway for many nurses. So a lot of the nurses that we get come from England, so they're imported, so they're totally different culture.
Ms. Maringi Kura-Campbell says a lack of health literacy means staff and consumers can talk past each other and people can feel intimidated when entering the system. Monique Valiafa says specific programs must be produced for Pacifica communities, and most importantly, services must make themselves more accessible.
The biggest problem we have in New Zealand is that our Pacific families and communities seem to have extremely high rates of mental illness, but really low rates of access to services. And what we see is Pacific families accessing in crisis, when we could have saved so much grief and disruption and distress for that family if we had have intervened early.
Salote and Anita have accessed services in the past, and Filetti encourages others to do so.
Seek help. And I know within Pacific Island culture there's a real sense of pride, of doing it yourself and standing on your own 2 feet with your head held high. But mental illness is such a serious problem, and it can manifest itself later on in life into attitudes and behaviours that can really destroy.
All three are in a good place at the moment, but acknowledge depressing times can be expected. Anita doesn't fear them.
My particular mental illness has actually driven me forward, because as much as I do have those moments, I also want to overcome those moments and become a better person and to create a life where I am a happier person and I'm more satisfied. So it's always that one dark moment can push me to create better moments.
And that's the key. Health worker, trainer, sufferer all say it's okay to be depressed, but your experiences must be shared and talked about. This is Koro Vakauta.
The Pacific community says Fiji's successful bid to preside over the United Nations Climate Change Conference is the added muscle needed to trigger more action. Recently, Fiji was appointed as the co-chair of next year's COP23 summit in Germany. The general director of the Pacific community, Dr. Colin Tukutongonunga, told Ben Robinson Drawbridge that Fiji's appointment is good news for the Pacific region.
It's fantastic news for the region because, despite the progress that was made up to the Paris Agreement and, of course, subsequently the ratification and the agreement entering into force, there are still influential people who might take a different view. And so, from the Pacific perspective, we just simply can't afford to let up. And who better to hoist the flag high and raise the Pacific voice at the global level than one of our own?
Why do you think, in particular, Fiji will be a good leader?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. Fiji is currently the chair of the UN General Assembly. That's a first for the region. And they've shown in other related negotiations excellent leadership for this region, particularly in respect of climate change. And Fiji, of course, has experience in both being affected by the negative impact of climate change, but also has been involved in discussions with Kiribati around what they might do if people were forced to leave their homes, for example. So they have a unique experience, if you like, to share with the rest of the world.
For Fiji to be appointed to roles of such prominence, does this not deflect some criticism of problems with its own democracy?
Oh, I think that's clearly a decision and a consideration that members of the international community has taken into account. And I would imagine if the international community doesn't have the confidence, then perhaps they might not have made the decision.
So what can other countries in the Pacific do, and what can the Pacific community do to support Fiji now?
This is where what we call ourselves the CROP agencies, the Council of Regional Organizations in the Pacific, SPC, the Pacific Communities, BREP, the Forum, and others step up and support Fiji in terms of the technical skills and information, and we've done that in terms of providing scientific and technical information and support. Obviously, the development partners have an important role to play in supporting and resourcing the delegations that are part and parcel of these negotiations, and of course the other island countries to provide support to Fiji in the actual negotiations. These are long, convoluted processes, and if you've got a scrum that's strong enough to hold up against what might come from the other way, I think it's clearly going to be very important for the Pacific region.
Descendants of hundreds of Cook Island men who enlisted in the First World War are fighting to preserve their stories of their ancestors. About 500 Cook Island men enlisted in the First World War, serving as laborers and munitions bearers in France, Egypt, Palestine, as well as parts of the Maori contingent. To commemorate their service, the Cook Island Soldiers World War I Committee tracked down the descendants of the first 45 men who enlisted and reacted their arrival at Parliament in New Zealand. Dania Marada Cox was there.
Figures in green carrying garlands of yellow shells walk against a backdrop of grey clouds and drizzling rain to stand on the lawns of Parliament in Wellington. Their descendants had arrived in similar conditions just over 100 years earlier, singing Tipperary and Are We Downhearted in Māori as they marched through the streets. Speaking at Parliament, National MP Alfred Naro told the descendants their ancestors' contribution deserves to be acknowledged.
They weren't drafted or enlisted, they were volunteered. On the 7th of October in 1915, the HMS Moana landed over here in Wellington. And in that morning, 45 Cook Island men who had enlisted marched up here to Parliament. Today is a reenactment of that period of time. It's a symbolism of young men who had chosen to serve not only their country, but also to the colony at that time. They came with the thought of adventure, and instead what they experienced was something quite different.
Lance Corporal Peter Solomono was one of those men. His descendant, Dan Kodaker, says it must have been a sharp contrast to his home island of Manihiki.
It's all new to him, coming into a new environment, to see all those big buildings here, and certainly a big contrast from a very small island with not that many people, and to meet all the parliamentarians, and especially the leaders of the Maori people, would have been a great honour for him.
Dan Kodaka says the commemoration has encouraged him to learn more about his ancestor.
I've heard little bits about him, but I think given this experience, it's given me the wanting to go and find out more about him.
The chairperson of the Cook Island Soldiers World War I Committee, Anne Allen Moitaua, says sparking a passion to remember their ancestors is the purpose of the commemoration.
We'll just continuously keep changing, keep pulling in people. That way then we can continue rather than the older people always holding on. So it's about, hey, you've learned what can happen. How about you take up the oar and start paddling?
The committee says it is still collecting historical accounts of the men who enlisted and invites people to get in touch with their stories.
A recently new film about a New Zealand-born Samoan strongman is aiming it to aspiring Pacific youth to dream big and work hard to achieve their goals. Better known as Matraten Mega Man, Levi Volga spent more than a decade pulling trucks, flipping tractor tires for hardware franchises, promoting the message big is good. But as the New Zealand-born Cook Islands filmmaker Jamie Akura Matradon discovers, In The Life I've Lived, there is more to Levy than meets the eye. He spoke to Karori Hawkins.
The reason why I've always been into inspirational videos and documentaries, and I have actually competed in strongman myself, so I kind of know that the sport of strongman is kind of faded in New Zealand. And I got to meet Levi through my time on training with strongman and competing. I actually had no idea that I only remembered him as the guy from Mighty Temeke, you know, the guy who said is good. But I actually had no idea that he competed on the World's Strongest Man stage like 11 times.
That is quite amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
And I've watched bits and pieces of the film, and it seems a very honest account of a person who's gone through a lot to get or to achieve what he wants to achieve. So it's quite a story in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's really humble about everything, you know. He's just a guy who, you know, I wanted to do this documentary because after doing a couple of training sessions with him, all I wanted to do really was give this guy recognition for what he should be known for.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, like he was saying in that first World Strongman tournament he went to, I see that there wasn't anyone that could train him because he was the first one in New Zealand to actually do the sport.
Yeah, exactly. So he did everything all by himself, you know, only having the help of his two best friends and, you know, the support from his family.
Yes, there's a deeper story about his time as a farmhand and sleeping on sacks of manure that he was selling to fund his tournaments. What was that about?
So pretty much because he got laid off work and he was trying to find a job, you know, and all that kind of stuff because everyone's got bills to pay. But his friend Freddie in the documentary, he actually said he believed in him from day one, saying that he could be, you know, he can go places with the strongman. And there was a competition show in Tabuki, so they pretty much just hopped in a van. And Freddie, being a typical Kiwi as he is, he said, "We'll sell bags of sheep shit to make our way." So they pretty much traveled for like a year or two living in a van and just bagging up sheep shit just to make enough money to travel to the next competition where, you know, they'll go and win it and they'll be $300, you know. So it's pretty much that's how it all started for him. They just literally traveled the whole of New Zealand going to local strongman competitions held at like AMP shows. And then from there, yeah, he just pretty much got an invitation, you know, Australasia's Strongest Man, and from he went to the world.
And it's also a story about perseverance, and towards the end of your film, it starts to crank up with all the accounts of what his life means and to the people around him as well. What do you think of it as terms of from a Pacific perspective in terms of overcoming challenges?
All I want this is to inspire the younger generation, to be honest. Like, you know, it shows that, you know, from him being Samoan, you know, that absolutely anything's possible and if you just put your mind to it. You know, that's the main purpose I do want to, you know, because he even states in the documentary, like, it doesn't even matter if it's strongman or anything, but if you put your mind to absolutely anything you want, you will achieve it.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Just to let you know, next week, the 27th of January, for those who are listening to this program for our partner stations, we will be bringing you a special program, as well as on February 3rd. And that's because the team for the weekly edition of the program is taking, well, another holiday just after we had one, this time for Chinese New Year. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long and take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.